Today's show is sponsored by Talkspace, the online therapy company. For a fraction of the price of traditional therapy, you can pick an experienced, licensed therapist you relate to and feel comfortable with. Each and every therapist has at least a master's degree and has completed over 3,000 hours of supervised work. To match with your perfect therapist, go to Talkspace.com/boom. And to show your support for this podcast, use code BOOM to get $30 off your first month. That's BOOM, Talkspace.com/boom, B-O-O-M.
You are Locked On Rockets, your daily podcast on the Houston Rockets, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.
Welcome in to another new episode of Locked On Rockets. I'm your host, Ben Dubose of Sports Talk 790. Today's Locked On Rockets is brought to you courtesy of SeatGeek. Download their mobile app for the easiest way to buy tickets, and the promo code LORockets will get you a $20 rebate on your first purchase from SeatGeek. So as we chat on this Wednesday afternoon, we all know the story that took place last night. Rockets 120-101 losers in Utah. They're now 11-7, 2-1 on this challenging five-game West Coast road trip. And really, it was a clunker of a game, so I'm not going to spend too much time breaking it down. It's one of those games that over 82, it's going to happen to everyone. The Rockets could not make their threes, especially early on. Jazz shot 55%, 53 from behind the arc. They're a very good team, playing at home, playing with purpose. They clearly wanted revenge on the Rockets for what happened 10 days ago in Houston, and they certainly got it. So we'll talk about that for a little bit, and then I think you guys might appreciate the back half of the show even more, because we are going to have Danny LaRue, host of the Twitter NBA show, host of Locked On Warriors, writer at the Sporting News. He's an expert on all things Warriors and, well, I'd say the NBA as a whole. So we're going to get to Danny to preview the big Rockets-Warriors matchup on Thursday night, as well as talk a little bit about his impressions of the Rockets this season. That's going to be on the back half of this show. To start off with, I'm going to just break down quickly what went wrong last night. Besides the obvious, the Rockets did not score enough points. Defensively, I'm not too concerned about that. It was a very hot shooting night for the Jazz at home. As we said, 55%, over 53% from three. I'm not so concerned with the 120 points the Jazz put up. I'm more concerned about the 101 that the Rockets put up, and that total was a little massaged by getting hot down the stretch and bringing the three-point total to, what, over 36%? So it certainly looked respectable, but remember, the Rockets were basically 20% in the first half, so a lot of the work they did to kind of make the stats look a little bit better and even get to 101 was done after the game was largely out of reach. Now, as I break down the Rockets' offense, I break it down into three categories: three-point shooting, pick-and-roll play, and isolation. And three-point shooting, you know, yes, three-point shooting is a part of both pick-and-roll and isolation. It's especially a part of the pick-and-roll game. But I segment it out because three-point shooting, it's inherently variable. You're going to have some games where you're really hot. You're going to have some games where you're cold. If you've ever played basketball before, you get it. Sometimes it's your night. Sometimes it's not. Sunday night was the Rockets' night. When they were in Portland, they shot 47% from three. And yes, they moved the ball well. Yes, Portland's defense was poor, but it's tough to shoot 47% against air. That's just how it works. They were a little lucky that night. And Tuesday night in Utah, they had a regression to the mean. Now again, they did ultimately get it up to 36%, but some of that came in the second half when the game was out of reach. When this game got out of hand in the first half and the Rockets couldn't answer, they shot 20% from three, and they were a little cold. But by and large, that's not where the Rockets lost this game. And overall, that stuff is going to even out. When you talk about, are the Jazz a bad matchup for the Rockets if they were to play in the playoffs? I think some of that is overdone. You're going to hear some people talking about the pace at which the Jazz play. But I think that can be a little bit of a misnomer, because the Rockets, they do play fast, but they're not the true 7 seconds or less. The Rockets play faster than the league average, but they're not, they're not close to the fastest. Last I looked, they're a top 10 team, but they're not historically fast or anything. They do play a lot of half-court basketball with the pick-and-roll game, with James Harden doing his thing. They're just really good at half-court basketball because of how well they can shoot and how dominant James Harden is. So I don't think the Jazz slowing the game. Certainly the Jazz were successful in making it a slower game in terms of possessions in both of these matchups than the Rockets might expect. But I don't think that's why the Rockets lost this game. And I think it's something they're fully capable of handling. And the same thing, to get back to the point, applies to the three-point shooting. You would like to see the Rockets make one or two more threes, especially in the first half, but I don't think that's where the game got away from them. I think where the game got away from them is in the pick-and-roll game, and especially the isolation game, which I'll get to in a second. So to start with the pick-and-roll, one thing the Jazz were very good at is limiting shot attempts from Clint Capela. We've talked a lot over the past week that defenses are starting to basically play the lob a lot more. The old Houston Rockets from a year ago, even though they were occasionally very good in the pick and roll, they simply didn't run it that often to make defenses truly fear it. And a lot of that was Dwight Howard's reluctance to be that pick and roll center. Well, one thing we've seen in the first month of this year, Clint Capela is willing to run that pick and roll until his legs fall off. And James Harden is willing to bludgeon teams to death with it. So that's what they did for really, I'd say, the first 3 weeks of the year. And over the past 10 days or so, teams like Utah have been pushing back. And with Utah, they're especially good at pushing back because Rudy Gobert, it's not just that he's long and physical, which he is, and that helps some. He's also very smart. He's very instinctual. And so he can sniff out when Harden is trying to make that pass, that little lob, that little drop off, and he can make Harden take contested floaters because that lob isn't there. And that's why Clint Capela only had 6 shot attempts. Nene only had 8. So yeah, you took away a lot of the big men out of the game, and James Harden, it was not his most efficient night, 8 of 23 from the field, but I don't think it was that different than the first time these two teams played in Houston when the Rockets won 111-102. That game, Harden was 10 of 24, and one of those makes was the big three over Dante Exum with 15 seconds left, which was really impressive, but while the game was already over by that point, and for all practical purposes, Harden could have equaled the stat line had D'Antoni left him in there to finish the game. 8 of 23, 10 of 24, the way the Jazz played him was very similar. The Jazz are able to take away a lot of the traditional pick-and-roll stuff. They can defend the three-point line respectably, I should say. Ryan Anderson, 3 of 5, that was good. Trevor Ariza, 0 of 4. One of the good things about the Jazz in terms of defending the three-point line, because Gobert is such a presence inside, you don't have to necessarily hedge as much with the wing defenders covering Ariza or Anderson in the corner, and so it makes you more able to take away that pass from Harden to the three-point arc. So the Jazz are a tough defensive team, but by and large, in terms of Harden, what they do, they make Harden take on more of a burden offensively. He's got to make more floaters. He's got to make more mid-range shots. And that's something that, in both matchups, he hasn't been great at. And some of it, you tip your cap to the Jazz. They're a good defensive team. You also hope that James, a bigger sample size, like if these teams played in the playoff series, you hope that that would even out. But getting back to the point, which is the impact on the Rockets' bigs, Gobert and the Jazz's ability to throw multiple long defenders at Harden, they're able to take the Rockets out of their comfort zone. And when you look at these two games, one a 19-point loss, another a 9-point win, Harden was really not that different in the two games. Where there was a big difference is the performance of the two big men. When the Rockets won in Houston, Clint Capela was 10 of 19 for then a career-high 20 points. Nene off the bench was 6 of 9 for 16 points. Combined, those two guys were 16 of 28 for 36 points. Tuesday night in Utah, it completely flipped. Capela, 4 of 6 for 8 points. Nene, 2 of 8 for 4 points. And so combined, they were 6 of 14 for 12 points. So you had 24 fewer points, significantly fewer shot attempts. And that goes into the third component of the Rockets' offense, which is isolation. Now, I know a lot of people think of isolation as James Harden doing stuff off the dribble in one-on-one settings with the clock going down, and that is a part of it. Another part of isolation is the post-game. And I throw it into isolation because it's basically, okay, your normal offense didn't work, you weren't able to get the easy shot out of the pick and roll, be it a three or the lob, so somebody's going to have to go out there one-on-one and make a play. And Clint Capela did that in the first game against Utah. He was 10 of 19, and I had a lot of those shots were not lobs out of the pick and roll. He made a lot of big plays when there just wasn't a lot going on in the Rockets offense, and he was able to drop in a hook over Rudy Gobert. Nene was 6 of 9. He did a lot of great things off the bench. They just gave it to him on the low block, or he was able to make an 18-20 footer, even made a 3 in that. And basically both of those guys, even when the offense broke down, you had the ability to create your own offense, and that's what kept the Rockets afloat. That's what kept the model sustainable against a good defensive team like the Utah Jazz. Unfortunately, the drawback to that, Clint Capela is not at a point where he could do that every night. And Tuesday night, they were able to take away the pick-and-roll game, and he was not able to, you know, respond in the half court the same way that he did 10 days ago in Houston. I think the 19 attempts were because, well, he built confidence, and, you know, he saw a couple of those hooks go in, and he kept shooting, and he had a great night. He was not able to build that confidence against Gobert on Tuesday night. The shot attempts were lower, and it just became to where Harden and Eric Gordon, I'll throw Gordon in there as well, were the only guys who could really create their own offense, and they ended up both being not as efficient as you would like. Harden, 8 of 23. Gordon did get to 8 of 17, but again, some of that came late. So I know a lot of you guys aren't going to want to hear it, but this is a game where you miss Donatas Mateutis, because Mateutis is another big that when things get ugly, you can throw the ball to on the low block, and he can create his own offense at least a little bit. That's what the Rockets missed in this game, because a lot of teams, Portland being the front of the list when the Rockets scored 130 on Sunday night, the Rockets can just run that pick and roll game to death. They can get the lobs, they can get the open threes. Tuesday night was a good example of when the first two parts of the offense, the pick and roll game and the three point game, don't go as you want. What happens then? And so when that happens, you need basically isolation plays, be it Harden creating off the dribble or somebody creating back to the basket, a big guy inside. You just got to have somebody make a play one-on-one, and maybe that unlocks the defense to where you can eventually get more of your usual pick and roll success. But 10 days ago, the big difference when the Rockets beat the Jazz was Clint Capela and Nene, their ability to make things happen one-on-one against Gobert, and ultimately that kind of opened up the floor a little bit for Gordon and Harden in the fourth quarter to close things out. They were not able to do that on Tuesday night in Utah, and eventually the Jazz just suffocated the Rockets. Going forward, you know, you hope that there's a blend. You hope that maybe your bigs can give you a little bit more in terms of creating in the post, but quite frankly, you could also use Donatas Mateutis, because on paper, he is by far your best candidate to give you that kind of offense. The other thing, you do expect a little more from James Harden, part of his 8 for 23. When teams defend the pick and roll the way the Jazz do, with Gobert staying back or, you know, hedging a defender onto the rolling big, you're going to have a lot more floaters for James Harden. It's one of those things where he can get the step on anybody, especially when he's coming around a pick. But this was a game, Harden was 8 of 23, but he only shot 6 threes. That tells you he had 17 field goal attempts from inside the arc. That is a very high number from James. And my recollection, he missed a lot of those floaters. He missed a lot of those shots around the basket. And there's nothing else to say other than he needs to make a little bit more. So when you diagnose how the Rockets get better than what they showed Tuesday night against the Jazz, should they meet in a playoff series, like I said, it starts with Harden making more shots inside the arc. And it starts with getting more production from your bigs, just like you did that first game against the Jazz in Houston. You hope Capela and Nene can find the versions of themselves that they had back then, but Donatas Mateutis could certainly help as well. When you want to see what the Rockets can do to get back to that, I think that's a much bigger factor than pace. I don't think the Jazz are necessarily a nightmare matchup, because as I was saying earlier, the Rockets, yes, they play fast, but they're not as fast as everybody thinks. They have had a lot of success in the half court, so I don't think that this is, you know, a recipe for just play slow and you can get the Rockets out of their style. It's more that the Jazz have a lot of unique matchups. They're a very good defensive team. You tip your cap. And also, you should point out that the Jazz were at full strength in this game. They didn't have George Hill the game in Houston. Gordon Hayward did not play well. George Hill was back for this game Tuesday night in Utah, and Gordon Hayward was much more like his usual self, shooting 50% from the field and 50% from three, scoring 31 points. Anyway, enough about the Jazz. Bad game. Going to get to previewing the Warriors with Danny LaRue in a second. For now, I want to acknowledge our great friends and sponsors at SeatGeek. Because we all know the stat, the Rockets have played, 12 of 18 on the road to this point. By the time they finish up this road trip at the end of this week, 14 of their first 20 will have been on the road. So that tells you there are a lot of home games coming up in December and January, especially over the holidays. So if you're coming back to Houston for the holidays and you'd like to catch a game, SeatGeek is by far the best place to do it. I've told you guys many times, I'm a huge fan of the secondary market because you can buy directly from season ticket holders. That typically gets you a much better deal than buying from the box office when they can use their dynamic pricing models to jack up the prices of tickets late. And when you look at the secondary ticket sites, SeatGeek to me is by far the most friendly. It's by far the best to use. So many reasons. You're guaranteed to get reputable tickets. Every ticket is backed by their guarantee. More importantly, they grade every ticket from 1 to 100. They search all the ticket sites so you know you're getting the best deal and you can easily get the most bang for your buck on your tickets. Most important part of this, as my listener, you can get a $20 rebate on your first purchase. And to get that, here's what you do. Download the SeatGeek app, go to the settings tab, and then click add a promo code. And then enter the promo code LORockets. SeatGeek will then send you $20 in the mail after you've made your first ticket purchase. So remember, download that SeatGeek app and enter the promo code LORockets today. So getting back into the show, we've had enough pessimism for one episode. Now, I know talking about the Warriors doesn't make anybody feel better, but by and large, let's keep it in perspective. The Rockets are 11-7 despite playing 12 of the 18 on the road. They're 2-1 so far on a very challenging West Coast road trip. There are a lot of positives to look forward to. The key for the Rockets, as I've said throughout, is to get to 3-2 on this road trip, get to 12-8, be a 600 team, both on the road trip and on the season as a whole, coming back home for this avalanche of home games in December and January when you can really make up some ground in a hurry. But to do that, they've got two more games on the road at Golden State on Thursday, at Denver on Friday. You'd like to get at least one of those, Denver on Friday obviously being the more likely candidate, but you know the Rockets, you know James Harden, you know Pat Beverly. These guys are cutthroat competitors. You know they're going to give it everything they have to try and shock the world and get that marquee win at Golden State on Thursday. Talk a little bit about that game, as well as, the Rockets' surprising season as a whole and how well they're doing, still tied for the number 4 spot in the Western Conference. I'm going to be joined momentarily by Danny LaRue. He's the host of Locked On Warriors, host of the Twitter NBA show, and also a writer for the Sporting News. So if you guys will hang with me, I'm going to get Danny on the phone, and he's going to break down, Rocket season as a whole, as well as this upcoming matchup with the Golden State Warriors. Danny, how's it going today?
Doing well. How are you?
Could be better if the Rockets didn't get blown out by the Jazz last night. Been talking
a
little bit.
That was a rough game.
Yeah, been talking a little bit about that game, but also the season as a whole. The Rockets, certainly it's not a season you would be disappointed in with them at 11-7, the 4 seed in the Western Conference. Just curious, before we get too much into Rockets-Warriors, just for your perspective on the team as a whole, relative to what you thought a month ago, where are the Rockets? Where have they surprised you, if anywhere?
I think I've just been surprised that they've done as expected. I mean, it's a Mike D'Antoni team. Harden has been spectacular. Overall, I think they've done a relatively good job. Won a few games that I didn't expect. Lost a few games I didn't expect, including opening night, though that feels like a lifetime ago. But
yeah.
Overall, I think they've done well, and they're also getting a little bit of good fortune that you mentioned. They're 11-7 and fourth in the West. That some of the teams that we expected to be real competitors for that last home court spot are faded a little bit now. But as you know, there's a long time left in the season.
Yeah, certainly the Memphis situation with Mike Conley helps the Rockets a little bit, at least for the time being. I'm curious, did you expect the Rockets to be as good as a rebounding club as they've been? Certainly they've scored a lot of points, which certainly folks expected in a Mike D'Antoni offense, but seeing them be as competitive on the glass as they've been, even without Dwight Howard, I know a lot of folks around the league have been caught off guard by that. Is that something that that you expected, or what's your take on that?
This is on the higher end of what seemed reasonably possible, but that happens. So Capella was an underrated rebounder. He's mm-hmm. the guy that I liked quite a bit because he's a capable rim protector and is a good rebounder. It's something I look for. It's part of the reason I love Rudy Gobert. And Capella, he doesn't fit that to the same degree that Rudy does, but no one really does at mm-hmm. this point. And Ryan Anderson, I followed his whole career. I was actually in college in the Pac-10 at the same time he was, and he was a really good rebounder most of his career, and then as he was dealing more with some of those back issues, that toned down a little bit, and so he looks in better health this year. And I think his effort has kind of coincided with that improvement in his health.
Yeah. Turning a little bit towards the team that you cover for Locked On Warriors, 16-2, certainly Golden State is not shocking anyone. This is a team that won 73 games a year ago and now has probably the most talented roster in NBA history. But for people that don't follow the Warriors on a day-to-day basis, one thing that's jumped out to me just looking at trends, defensively, the first 10 games or so, there were some weaknesses. And now it seems like in the past, you know, 5 to 8 games, the Warriors have really shored things up on that end of the floor. How have they improved? Where are where are the Warriors an even better team now than the version they were 2 or 3 weeks ago?
Defense, in particular, takes a bigger adjustment. Offense, you know, like for those of us who play pickup, you know, you can generally figure some of that out relatively quickly. You know where a guy's good and all that. But defense relies on communication and familiarity. So those improve over time. Last year, the Warriors had so much continuity that they didn't have to deal with that. You know, everybody knew where their guys were going to be the scheme, and there were a lot of adjustments, even though some of this actually, they went back to some old habits against the Hawks, that you just have to change the game plan a little bit because Dasa Pachulia and Andrew Bogut are very different players. They have different strengths and different weaknesses, and so they're using that. And also, the Warriors started out the season defensively a little bit flat. There isn't as much motivation for them this year. Like last year, they were just going nuts for every single game. They really wanted that. They had something to prove. And this year, they have something to prove, but the something is in May and June, it isn't now.
Yeah. I'm curious about that Hawks game. They, you know, obviously the Hawks did not win, but the Hawks were at least able to push them. For those who missed that game, what was the recipe? What did Atlanta do right that at least gave them a shot to be competitive in Oakland?
Two big things. One, they turn the Warriors over a lot. The Hawks do that very well. They are one of the best teams at generating turnovers. And they had, I think it was 11 steals in the first 3 quarters. And steals in particular are great because those are live ball turnovers. You get transition. If the Rockets were able to do that to the Warriors, they would get a ton of points and free throws off of that. And the other point, which is kind of a broader thing for the Warriors, is that they have trouble with smaller, quick point guards because you can't, like, sometimes the Warriors bounce Steph Curry, Klay Thompson, between the defensive assignments, depending on the situation. They did that in the playoffs last year, for example, not against the Rockets, but against other teams. But you don't really want to put Klay on those waterbug point guards either because he's a bigger dude. He's better on the strong guys. So Curry can struggle with them. Klay struggles with them. And so Schroeder had one of the best nights of the season. That won't happen too often. But one of the issues, and this goes back to what we were talking about before, is how that used to work was Curry would often funnel that player towards Andrew Bogut, and Bogut would clean up the mess, and that was kind of their defensive scheme. Dasa Pachulia is not exactly as adept at doing that as Bogut, so they might have to figure out a different solution, at least in the regular season, because in the playoffs, they're probably going to be going more to the small lineups, and Draymond Green can do that.
Yeah. As far as how they defend the Rockets, one thing that struck me about the Warriors in the past, they have not been keen to double team all that often. Now, of course, the Warriors have a stable of long defenders with reach that can give Harden some difficulties, but the approach in the past has largely been, even if James Harden has a great game, and I think back to, you know, the 2015 Western Conference Finals when games 1 and 2 in Oakland, Harden was just absurd. That's as good as I've ever seen him play. And yet the Rockets still did not win either of those games, in large part because of how successful Oakland was at limiting the part, or Golden State, I should say, of limiting the parts around James. And I would suspect that now that the Rockets have a more perimeter-friendly supporting cast, Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson, I would think that, by and large, the philosophy stays the same. Because if you were worried about the supporting cast, you know, even before the likes of Eric Gordon and Ryan Anderson were in place, I would imagine that now, you know, that emphasis is even more so from Steve Kerr, just due to the fact that even if Harden gets his 40, the Warriors have such superior depth elsewhere that they should probably win most of the games against Houston.
we're in agreement there, and it makes a lot of sense. I actually think more teams should use the Warriors' approach there against the Rockets because they have so many players, in particular Gordon and Ryan Anderson, that can take advantage of if you give them open shots, they can, whether it's making that shot themselves or creating an opportunity, but it's a lot harder when there's a guy standing right there. They certainly can. They're great offensive players. They can do more than that. But when you ratchet up the degree of difficulty, it certainly helps. And Harden is spectacular. He's a serious MVP candidate. But there's only so much any individual player can do unless somebody's going to hang 60 on someone, and that's probably a little bit much. So that's something I want to watch and see if the Warriors employ more of a switching system. And maybe you get into some uncomfortable individual matchups, but you don't create those seams that the Rockets are so good at exploiting.
Yeah, I would agree there. You look at the Portland game Sunday, that was a game that was tailor-made for Harden to attack. And, yeah, seams is the right word. Harden found the seams, and it was just open three-point shot after open three-point shot, and that's what plays to James's strength. Another thing that's happened with the Rockets these past couple of weeks, just watching them game in, game out, I know you watch them a lot too, it feels as if teams are anticipating the Harden-Capella pick-and-rolls more. Whereas a year ago, of course, the Rockets had the pick-and-roll in their arsenal, but because Dwight Howard was so reluctant to run it on any sort of consistent basis, I don't think you saw teams fully adjust. Adjust isn't the right word. They just didn't fully prepare because it happened so infrequently. Whereas now, Harden and Capella, they will run that pick-and-roll until they bludgeon a team to death with it. So what's happened a lot these last couple of weeks, since Capella moved into a 30-plus minute per game role, you're seeing a lot more teams play Harden for the pass, anticipate that he's going to get the lob to Clint Capella or the drop-off. And I'm curious what the evolution is, what you think the Rockets can do to counter that. To me, and I saw this during the game last night against the Jazz, it seems like the obvious answer is that Harden's got to develop more of a floater game, because if teams are going to sag off and play for that potential role, quite frankly, the only way to get them out of it is if James Harden starts to become more of a scorer and convert on some of those opportunities himself. I'm just curious your take on it, because to me, as a Rockets fan, an analyst, just looking at the way things have gone these last couple of weeks, it seems like teams are progressively playing Harden for the pass more and more on those pick and rolls.
It's definitely a challenge if the defenders are in the right position, because there are certain situations where you can just take advantage of it, but being a scorer is the next stage, because a lot of players, their general defensive instinct is to treat guys as scorers, not as passers, so they actually have to be kind of coached into treating them as a passer. An example of this is Draymond Green is still handled as a scorer in those circumstances when he's almost always passing. So the counter to that is to try to score, to get an in-between game, and also to know how to take advantage of help that comes in from somebody other than the guys involved in the pick-and-roll defense. So a lot of times the big benefit that you get from having the other team play the pass is, as you move closer to the basket, somebody else on the defense freaks out and comes over to help or does something else. And Harden is one of the best guys in the league. LeBron is still number one by a mile in this, of seeing that, even if it's like a one-step move, and then hitting that guy. And the Rockets now have the right personnel to take advantage of that, because if Harden can make that pass, that player on the Rockets needs to be able to take that shot without hesitation and then make that shot enough to basically create a no-win situation for the defense.
Good point. Turning back to your team, for folks that haven't watched them too much, obviously they're loaded with talent, but let's say this game, hypothetically, it's tight in the fourth quarter. How different is the offense with Kevin Durant? Now, obviously, they're a lot better. Everyone understands that. He's much more talented. But relative to the sets, the plays that the Warriors implemented the last 2 years, when Stephen Curry, Klay Thompson, Draymond Green, Harrison Barnes, everyone knows that core, what is the difference now? If it's close and late, how are they using Kevin Durant? What are some of the things they're doing that are different, that it's not just the Rockets, that could pose any team a unique challenge?
I'll talk about the second part first, because Coach Kerr is doing something interesting that I wasn't sure about before the season, and that's that he's using a pretty clear stagger with Durant. So what he's doing is Durant is actually the first guy out for the Warriors in the first and third quarter. Iguodala comes in, then Durant sits for a couple minutes, and then he comes in and finishes the first and third, and then stays in for the beginning of the second fourth. So what that means is you're almost definitely getting a few minutes with Durant against backups, and there are basically no second unit guys in the league that can defend KD. He often takes a much larger distribution role in that time. He plays with Livingston, but a lot of times the ball is in Durant's hands, which has actually caused some weird adjustments for Sean Livingston. And those lineups are generally doing well. David West has been involved and all that. But in crunch time, it's not that different right now than it was last year, but I fully expect that to change over the next couple months when they just fully integrate him at that point. Also, when the Warriors have played shockingly little crunch time.
True.
Before the Hawks game, they'd only played 9 minutes within 5 points in the last 5 minutes of the whole season.
Wow.
You know, so we haven't seen a lot of it, but it looks similar. And one thing that makes the Warriors really different, and as somebody who covers the Rockets, you'll know this immediately, is that the Warriors fully embrace the idea of running their stuff and having whoever ends up being open take the shot. So it varies a lot from game to game. Like, for example, Klay Thompson against Atlanta had 11 points in the first quarter and then didn't really have a ton of other shots the rest of the game. I think he had about 11 total in the other three quarters combined. So you're always going to have seams against the Warriors because they have guys that you want to double, they have guys that draw a lot of attention, but they have reached the point already, which, I mean, I thought was maybe an end game at maybe the end of the regular season or the beginning of the playoffs, where it doesn't really matter who takes that shot on a given moment. It's just that it's a good shot. And that's terrifying for the league because that's
Absolutely.
The offensive idea that the Spurs have used. The Spurs have basically said, you know, some nights it's going to be Kawhi, some nights it's going to be Manu, going back to Robert Horry, it was going to be him. And when you have some of the best open shot makers in the entire league on the team, it kind of takes that Rockets idea that we talked about with Ryan and Gordon to the nth degree when you replace those guys with Steph Curry and Kevin Durant.
Yeah, and by the way, hashtag Warriors problems. The fact that you've never, you know, been so rarely in close games that you don't really have enough experience. Yeah, I think those of us in Houston would love to have problems like that. Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head, by the way, in that the difference in this game, and really a lot of games when you're playing the Warriors, because they're able to stagger the minutes, it's Kevin Durant against the bench. Those minutes that you can give, and that's been an issue for Houston all year. Now it's gotten a little bit better the last couple of weeks. Since they got Pat Beverly back, those minutes without James Harden, it's been easier for the Rockets to kind of stabilize. Whereas before, you know, they did stagger the minutes to where Eric Gordon was coming off. You made a good point on your show with Nate about, you know, does Gordon have enough juice, or, you know, can he handle when the defense throws all their juice at him? And he kind of struggled in that role. Well, now, ever since Pat Beverly's come back and Gordon doesn't have to do the ball handling and he can play more away from the ball, he's been better at that. However, certainly the Rockets are very dependent on James Harden, and whatever six-minute stretch he sits out, it's going to be troublesome, especially if the Warriors are able to throw Kevin Durant out there. The one thing I'm curious to get your take on before we wrap up, one change that Mike D'Antoni has made the last couple of games, to start the year, the minutes without Harden were always at the beginning of the second and fourth quarters. And, you know, he would come out in the quarter break and he would come back with somewhere between 5 and 7 minutes left. So the 10 to 12 minutes that he had off, that was where it was. Recently, D'Antoni's been flipping that. I think he doesn't like how that kind of boxes him in. So he's been taking him out at about the 2 to 3 minute mark of the first and third quarters, thus enabling him to bring Harden back a little bit early in the second and fourth. There's one drawback to this. The drawback is that Harden's probably the best player in the league at 2-for-1 scenarios, and it takes him out of play for those, the end of the first and third. But the upside, of course, it gives D'Antoni more options. As you look at the Rockets, is that the right play? Does that materially change the rotation at all in your eyes?
It's more about the rhythm of all the players involved. The 2-for-1 aspect is incredibly important. And it's funny to me because what you described in terms of the change is actually goes from Steph Curry's sub-pattern, which is finishing the first quarter, to Klay Thompson's sub-pattern, which is pulling 2 to 3 minutes before, because the Warriors have this weird, they're trying out some different ideas with kind of 2 and 2. And it really is about rhythm. I've talked with Durant a little bit about that, and Clay too, about the idea of, you know, when you're going to sub. He's like, well, it sucks to come out when you're going really well. Mm-hmm. So you want to have continuity. You want to have continuity in terms of who's playing with whom. But I also like the idea of being a little bit more flexible with it. So, you know, if Harden has it going, maybe you push it a little bit farther. I also am a big fan of the idea, which more teams need to do, of catching short breaks, using the mandatory timeouts to your advantage,
yes,
and going a little bit in that way. And so maybe you add 2 minutes to the mandatory, like you pull Harden, so like maybe at the 4 minute mark for a minute or two, then bring him back for the last two, and you kind of play it by ear. Because I don't know if it's just my own experience in athletics, but usually those first like 2-3 minutes of rest matter a lot more than the next six. So maybe going to that approach could be good with Harden. It can be hard on the rest of the team, but he's such a central part of everything they do that I think if you have one star, that's probably the way I would approach it.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
I actually had a question for you.
Go ahead.
So one of the things that I've noticed with the Rockets this year, both from the eye test and statistically, is that they've done a pretty good job of getting back in transition defense. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering, from what you've seen so far, is like they're middle of the pack, and that was something that, you know, they've had their struggles defensively, but it hasn't been that. Is that something D'Antoni's emphasizing, or is it just that they've done a good job from an effort perspective so far this year?
It's definitely something that he emphasized. It was one of the things that they mentioned on the first day of camp. And a lot of it, quite frankly, it starts with James Harden, because when you think transition defense, so much of it is your backcourt. And it's something that Pat Beverly, he had a few low lights last year, but he generally plays well defensively. Now, one little thing about the Rockets, it's a small sample size. Pat Beverly, his defense as a whole, this is the best I've seen Pat Beverly defend in 2 or 3 years. So whatever they did with his knee, that procedure, these last couple of weeks defensively, this is the kind of play out of Pat Beverly that Rockets fans haven't seen really for 2 or 3 years. So that's encouraging. But the bigger thing is Harden, because a lot of times transition defense comes down to, you know, your guards that are near the top of the key and those guys getting back. And it's something that James just did not do a year ago. And part of it was not all his fault. Some of it was the offseason ankle injury that he had. He came in a little bit out of shape because of that. And there is a fitness issue. But the one thing I'll give James credit for, he's taken a lot of the criticism to heart. And he's playing harder than I've ever seen. Just from a sheer effort standpoint. And, you know, some of it's certainly him doing, and I think he was motivated to redeem himself no matter who the coach was. But Mike D'Antoni does deserve a lot of credit, because it's something from the opening press conference to the first day of training camp that he's emphasized. And so they're much better. Transition defense, where they were just deplorable a year ago. And now they are at least respectable. Another thing I would point out, Corey Brewer has had a very solid under-the-radar season. Not a lot of people talk about him. Rockets fans, you know, he always bothers them because he can't really shoot that well, but he's so good in the transition game. If you look, it seems like almost every game, Brewer is one of the Rockets' leaders in plus-minus, and that's an area where he does surprisingly well. He's got good instincts, he contests, he works hard. So I would say the trio of, you know, Beverly and Brewer having bounce-back years and Harden being committed, I think those three guys, that's where you're seeing them have more success in transition defense than they had a year ago. Speaking of the same theme, I thought of one more thing that I wanted to ask you. People fixate a lot about Harden's defense, and some of the metrics do show his improvement through the first month of the year. One of the things the NBA Twitter has had a lot of fun with these last couple of weeks has been how low some of the metrics grade Klay Thompson. And so I'm just curious your take. Is Klay, by the eye test, has Klay's defense slipped as much as some of the metrics would seem to indicate? Or are there some extenuating circumstances with that?
There are extenuating circumstances. Okay. So Klay's offense, his defense has been weaker, I would say, a little bit than it has been in the last couple of years. So that there is a kernel of truth to it, as you would expect, mm-hmm. you know, when you see that. But I've had some people want to have me explain this. And so basically, if let's say we're talking about RPM, so ESPN's proprietary black box thing with that. Part of what RPM relies on is what's called the box score prior. And basically that's how a player does in those traditional box score stats. And that's rebounds, steals, assists, all that sort of thing. Of course, steals, assists don't matter for defensive RPM, but you get the idea. Klay Thompson, despite being a good defensive player, is one of the worst players in the league at getting rebounds and getting steals. So while his defensive impact is hard to measure in terms of those box score stats, and so that weighs him down.
Mm.
And he actually has done a better job. I can't remember which game it was. It was about a week and a half ago. The Warriors got shellacked on their defensive glass, and so their guards have actually made more of an effort to get back and try to get an extra rebound or two a game. So that's improved. But Klay is always going to look bad in terms of those numbers unless he fundamentally changes his ability to get rebounds and steals. There are certain players that are always overrated and underrated by that. DeAndre Jordan's a guy who's often overrated by it because he just is a monster at getting rebounds. And so is, in some ways, so is David Lee, because he, like any guy who's a rebound thief, gets a little bit overrated in defensive RPM. And Klay is the exact opposite of that. So it ties in with all of that kind of stuff, runs together with him. And it's also part of the reason why you want to balance stats with the eye test. Everything is a part of the same story. Everything tells a part of it, and you just have to be able to discern, to separate the wheat from the chaff with your own experience. And part of the fun of this is that nothing is ever perfect.
Yep. I think we can leave it off there and agree on that point wholeheartedly. Danny, thank you so much for the time. For your listeners, I'll toss out my information. If you ever want to hear more from me, I will bombard you on Twitter all the time about Houston sports. You can follow me there at Ben Dubose. And this is Locked On Rockets. You can also follow the show at Locked On Rockets. And my work, I work for Sports Talk 790. That's the official flagship station of the Rockets. And so I have a page on sports790.com that's based out of Houston, where I have all sorts of analysis of the Rockets, way more than any of the Warriors fans would ever care to read, I'm sure. For my listeners, Danny, toss out your affiliations, where you work, basically where people can find you if they're not already subscribers to all of your shows.
So I'm at Danny LaRoux on Twitter. That's DannyLeroux. I do Locked On Warriors. I do a weekly Real GM radio podcast and the Dunked On Basketball podcast, which is pretty much daily. And then also for Rockets fans, for this game, Rockets Warriors, Nate Duncan and I have just launched, a couple weeks ago, we launched the Twitter NBA show, which is a live show. It's streaming on Twitter and on Periscope. And we're going to do a halftime show of Warriors Rockets. So right as the final buzzer sounds, like a minute later, we're going to do a 10-minute show. And then we will do a 30 to 45-minute thing after that game, talking about both that and Cavs Clippers. So if you want to take a look, you can follow me on Twitter or follow Nate Duncan on Periscope. His handle, I believe, is Nate Duncan NBA.
Excellent. Danny, thank you so much for the time, and I'll be talking with you during the game, I'm sure. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Sure thing. That was Danny LaRoux. Great guy, tremendous asset to the Locked On Podcast Network. Does a great job covering the Warriors. Appreciate him taking the time to break down the game with us. I think we're a little bit over our time already, so I won't say anything else. We'll just wrap up the show and, well, get ready for the game tomorrow night in Oakland. So, again, if you want to follow me, you know where to do it, at Ben Dubose, at Locked On Rockets. And please feel free to email us at lockedonrockets@gmail.com if you've got questions for me, or if you would like to inquire about potentially becoming a sponsor of this show, just as SeatGeek was today. Remember, use that promo code LORockets, and with SeatGeek.com or their app, you can get a $20 rebate off of your first ticket purchase. So stay tuned for more coverage in the next couple of days. Rockets close out the road trip at Golden State on Thursday, at Denver on Friday. Not going to beat a dead horse, but you guys know my take, the game in Golden State. I'd certainly like to see the Rockets compete, but they have to be very aware of that game in Denver on the second night of a back-to-back, fifth of a five-game road trip. That's a potential schedule loss. So if the Rockets are not really in the game in Golden State, I hope that Mike D'Antoni is a tad bit more aggressive than he usually would be in terms of pulling some of his regulars. We'll see if that actually happens, because as I was talking about with Calvin Watkins on Twitter last night, you know, resting is not quite in the Rockets' DNA like it is for the Spurs and Greg Popovich. But it's something that, you know, you want to come out of this road trip at 3-2, want to come out at 12-8 after your first 20 games. 600 is a good baseline at this point in the year. So if you want to do that, you have to be very careful with how you manage that Warriors game. Of course, maybe they'll shock the world, and you know that the Rockets have some big-time competitors like James Harden, like Pat Beverly, like Trevor Ariza, that are going to want to go out there and play their best game on in such a big stage against the Warriors, and we hope they do that. And you know what, if you want to hear more about the game as it's going on immediately after, just check out that new Twitter NBA show hosted by Danny LaRue, who was just with us, and Nate Duncan. So thanks again to Danny for joining us. Thanks again to you for listening, and I will be chatting with you again over these next 2 days as the Rockets wrap up their road trip. Have a good day.